Rashida, you being taken out by security as you were standing there. Talk about what you were chanting in these last 30 seconds, what you were demanding of then-candidate Donald Trump.
I was asking him, as he comes less than a mile away from where I live, is if he ever read the U.S. Constitution, and what part of the U.S. Constitution does he believe in? I think it's so important that we really get back to who we are. And Trump's America is not who we are. And it was really my most American thing that I could ever have done is ask him a question that day, alongside with 12 other incredible women who also asked about labor rights, sexual harassment in the workplace.
Could you see yourself doing the same thing again with you as a Congress member and him as president?
I'm bringing my bullhorn to the floor of Congress, Amy.
Well, we're going to do part two of this discussion, and we'll play that as well and post it at democracynow.org. We particularly want to ask you about what democratic socialism is. We've been speaking with Rashida Tlaib, who's poised to be the first Muslim woman elected to Congress. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in on Thursday, August 30th at 8 p.m. to celebrate the Native programmers and the Native community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Jack Malmstrom of Rose City Native Radio will host this special on-air program. You can join us at the Native Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 30th. More information about the Native Community Open House and the anniversary programming can be found at KBOO.FM.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Hopworks Urban Brewery, 10 years of local and sustainably sourced beer, with three locations in Portland and Vancouver, hosting the first Salmon Safe IPA Festival on Saturday, August 25th at Hopworks Urban Brewery on Southeast Powell Boulevard, featuring 20 breweries and beer brewed with certified Salmon Safe ingredients. Tickets and more information available at SalmonSafeIPAFest.com and HopworksBeer.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, tributes are rolling in for the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, who passed away earlier today.
A Portland man is facing a charge for a homophobic bomb threat.
And after days of unhealthy levels, are Oregon's air finally safe to breathe?
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 16th, 2018. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Annette Newell. The air quality in Portland's improving, but is still considered unhealthy for sensitive groups. The smoke and haze that have descended on the city for the past 2 days are starting to clear out. However, according to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, the air is still considered unhealthy for special groups. As of this afternoon, the air quality index for Portland registered at 64, which is moderate. There is still in the range of being potentially hazardous for older residents, people with respiratory conditions, and young children. For surrounding areas, the poor air quality has not improved, especially in southern Oregon, where large wildfires are still burning. In Grants Pass, the air quality index is at 138, and Medford, the index has reached 187, which is unhealthy. Currently, the worst air quality is in Ashland, where the index has gone up to almost 200. Air quality in that range is considered unhealthy for everyone. According to the National Weather Service, the skies are expected to further clear in Portland through tomorrow.
The MAX train stabbing suspect has been charged with assaulting a black inmate while behind bars. The Oregonian reports that Jeremy Christian was charged with attacking Andre Mills while in the Multnomah County Jail. Christian is already facing previous murder charges. In 2017, he stabbed three people on a MAX train. Riders on the train tried to stop him as he hurled anti-Muslim threats at two black teenage girls. Ricky Best and Talisa Namka Mechi died from their wounds after the attack. Christian has pleaded not guilty and told investigators his motive was not racism, although weeks before the MAX attack, he attended a right-wing rally where he was seen giving a Nazi salute.
A Portland man's been charged with one count of intimidation for threatening to bomb an apartment complex that houses people with AIDS and HIV. According to documents filed in the Multnomah County Circuit Court, Scott Wayne Smith used a homophobic slur against two residents of the Hopewell Apartments. Smith also reportedly threatened to, quote, kill all you people. One resident who called law enforcement said that Smith had harassed him and other LGBTQ residents of the apartment complex over a period of weeks. The resident told police he was afraid, did not feel safe with the neighbor living so close, and that he believed that Smith would do what he said. Smith is in custody and has pleaded not guilty to the misdemeanor charge.
The Colorado baker who won a Supreme Court case after refusing to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple is back in court again. Jack Phillips, owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop in Lakewood, Colorado, is suing state officials over religious discrimination after he refused to make a cake celebrating a gender transition. The new case involves an incident that occurred in June of 2017. Lawyer Autumn Scardina asked for a cake with a pink interior and blue exterior to celebrate the anniversary of her transition from male to female. Scardina said, "The woman on the phone told me that they do not make cakes celebrating gender changes." Phillips later added, "That's a cake I can't create for anybody." In June of this year, Colorado regulators argued that it was sufficient evidence to support Scardina's claim of discrimination. Phillips' attorney said that the state is continuing to single out Jack for punishment and to exhibit hostility towards his religious beliefs. Phillips told Colorado Public Radio, "I know the Bible says that God created male and female and that we don't get to choose that, and we don't get to change that. And I don't feel like the government has a right to compel me to participate in creating a cake that promotes that message." Phillips is now asking the court for permanent injunctions against the state from enforcing Colorado's anti-discrimination laws, as well as $100,000 in punitive damages. Colorado Governor John Hinkenlooper is named as a defendant in the lawsuit, said he expects the issue will return to the Supreme Court. Danielle Ramos from LGBTQIA advocacy group One Colorado responded to the case saying, "All people, including LGBTQ people, deserve to be served equally in public space, and no religious belief gives anyone the right to pick on and choose whom they serve and what law they want to follow."
A local artist who's also experiencing houselessness offers a unique perspective. For a discussion of art, life, and surviving in Portland, KBOO's Teresa Mitchell spoke with Jeff Letticoat and his curator.
All right, who do I have in the studio with me?
I'm Andrew Jankowski. I am a former curator at the Littman White Galleries at Portland State University.
And Jeffrey Letticoat, activist, artist,
personality.
All right, Jeffrey Letticoat, you have an ongoing exhibition right now. Is that correct?
Right, at a couple different places. 12th and Burnside, on an ongoing basis, have a thing that's been called the Outsider Art Gallery, which is a place where I work as well as live. And on display are the wood sculptures that Andrew has helped be displayed at Littman Gallery at PSU University.
All right, and this is described in the literature here as exhibition space and campsite. Is that the same one?
Yes, 12th and Burnside. But where things are currently on display and we encourage people to go check out is at PSU, Smith Memorial Center, next to the Student Union in the Littman Gallery.
All right, and this has to do with Ariella Tai as well.
That's correct. I'm here to talk about Ariella's work in the context of the exhibition, which is called A Story to Texture. And yeah, I wanted to pair both of the artists because they had really compelling work that needed to be talked about, like, alongside each other.
I see. So yeah. The combination of Jeffrey Lidicote's sculptures, wood sculptures, and Ariel Atai's video work, multi-channel video installation. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that's a combination of hallucination and installation.
Sort of feels like it.
These are being presented together, conceptually together, or are they actually physically together?
Physically together. Okay. In some cases, some of the sculptures are placed literally like next to, on top of some of the TVs that are there, or some of them are... They're balanced together throughout the gallery. I think people will mostly be seeing Jeffrey's sculptures, but Ariella's TV installations wind up providing a lot of illumination as well.
And where is Littman Gallery?
It's at 1825 Southwest Broadway. It's up at Portland State University in the Smith Memorial Student Union on the second floor.
Okay.
And that's, it's part of, there's two galleries at PSU, but it's the one that has, like, the two glass doors. And one of the people at the show called it bisexual lighting, which I was just like, yes, that's so accurate.
Well, and tell me more about the decision to bring these two types together. What did you want to express?
Yeah, so both of their works, to me, they deal with, you have to understand them as a result of looking at their texture and understanding, like, their placement, and not just, like, you know, glancing at them and walking by, but really taking time to take them in. Both artists' works, I'll speak more for Ariel than Jeffrey, but... their works deal with this perspective of being marginalized and being kind of and dealing with violence and trauma and how kind of to, like, cope with that. How to so a lot of the works in Ariella's part of the exhibition deal with how Black trauma is presented in cinema and in television. And they take these examples from, like, they were really inspired by the character Hodor from Game of Thrones. Is a really big component of their work. But it also, like, some of what Ariella's statements deal with include these questions that they want us to ask ourselves, like, how do we talk about things that we're not supposed to? What happens when we see what is deliberately hidden? Who do we fail when we are messy, irreverent, or bitter? And how do we handle, process, and heal from the pain we're expected to bear with grace? And I live kind of nearby Jeff's campsite, and I've been familiar with his work just as part of him being part of, like, our neighborhood. But then one night I was passing by Jeff's campsite, and I really got to, like, talk with him, and he had, like, his lights out. And one of my colleagues described the show as being very imaginative, like, to see Jeff's sculptures. Some of them look like these forms that you're very familiar with, like birds, or I mean, some of them I just thought of as being like cryptids, you know, these just really, like, I don't know, Guillermo del Toro monsters almost.
Are,
like,
these found wood forms, or are these
Yes. So I spent a fair amount of time down at the river and digging up roots here and there, and kind of mixing that. It's like playing the cloud game. What do you see in the clouds for me? And I see in the outdoors a lot of different forms, faces, creatures, and I don't see that when I'm indoors, really, which I think should tell us something about humans. It seems the more that humans touch things, the less they reflect the spirit that I see. But yes, found wood that then sometimes it'll be a single piece, sometimes two or three pieces or more mixed together.
And they're put together with just as minimal, I guess, interruption as you would think. Like, a lot of it is more like balancing wood rather than like glue or nails, although that is a part in some cases. A lot of it is just balance, which is really kind of astounding to me, especially with, you know, like the weather and like people walking by when you're over on Burnside.
I'm kind of trying actually to put things more together because I want to sell things.
Right.
The less that I can do in terms of my own intervention in the piece, it seems the better it turns out, because I think the things have been quite well made from the get-go.
So these are sculptural compositions using found wood.
Mostly, but I'm not dogmatic about it or anything. Uh-huh. I'm perfectly happy sometimes to incorporate metals as well as other.
I see. Okay. It says in your PR release here that the Pacific Patrol Services, a contractor for the city, has come by and disrupted and damaged your sculptures.
Well, like they do to anybody else that's out living differently than... And I have a difficult time with terms like homeless. To me, when I'm headed towards my place, it feels like home, and I know the place is, aesthetically pleasing, especially at night when I've got... the place lighted up, and it feels like going. It feels the same as it does when I'm going indoors and I'm going to watch television. When I'm headed back to my place and I'm about to listen to KBOO radio, it feels exactly the same feeling that I get when I'm headed anyplace else. I say that the difference between the people that live indoors and the people that live outdoors is we have thin walls, our tarps and our tents, and they have thin skin.
How did it feel going to the Littman Gallery and assembling and collaborating your work with Ariella Tai's video work?
Well, it's been great. I mean, I had questions at first because, well, to take what I see as pieces for outside for the most part, inside, kind of worried about that, and then electronics all around, and the creatures were very nervous about the whole setup. But as it turns out, it looks great, and the pieces are very comfortable, and the videos running with sound keep them, you know, they're kind of used to the noise of traffic and the like. So it all works out. I mean, I wouldn't say that the pieces don't reflect trauma. The pieces reflect something other than trauma, but I'm thoroughly traumatized. Like you were starting to talk about Pacific Patrol. Three times I've had all of my pieces taken and destroyed by the police, well, two times destroyed by the police, and one time I got it back. And this last time, just shortly before the show was to begin at Littman Gallery, they took everything. They dismantled the pieces, which, you know, happens as a matter of course in part. But they also went out of their way, I think, to, you know, break pieces that shouldn't have gotten broken.
That was like, yeah, the month before, the weeks before we were trying to get the show together, a bunch of them got destroyed. So some of the ones that you see at Littman, they aren't necessarily how they were intended to be. They're sort of the result of coming back together after being carted off to deep southwest Portland. Still kind of near, you know, public transit, but like when you've got, you know, all your stuff, like all of your worldly possessions, and then trying to get back on the bus. And like Jeff was saying, this isn't something that just happened to him. This is something that happens to a lot of people in Portland. I can say that, like, when we were putting the show together and I was telling my colleagues at the gallery about what Jeff was going through, they were just deeply shocked and disturbed, frankly, just for lack of a better word, because I think to them, you know, art is one of these things that is protected by the First Amendment. It is something that is so important, especially now. So to have an authority figure come in and really, like, displace him, this is almost, in a way, I think, a different way of thinking about, like, the sweeps that have been going on. Like, the last time I was here at KBOO, we were talking about Wendy Dyer's exhibition at Littman, which also dealt with, like, this concept of, like housing rights in Portland, the Camp Here Tonight series. So I think this is kind of like a continuation of that as well, is, like, getting people to think outside of, like, if there's this big story that they're familiar with, like, getting them to see it from a different angle or getting them to kind of interrupt their thinking about it. So that to me is, like, a really big achievement of this show, is, like, there's this, it's almost like this exercise in intersectionality. So I hope that when people go to the Littman Gallery, they'll see something that they can understand, something that they can connect with, and even maybe something that they can't connect with immediately and struggle with a little. But I just want people, like, when they see Jeff and Ariella's work together, that they will come away knowing something, you know, they'll learn something that they didn't know before, or, like, see themselves reflected, like, almost like a looking glass or like a funhouse mirror in a way. But that was kind of my idea in curating them both together.
And that is kind of what I like about the Littman Gallery, too, and the work that Andrew has done in setting up the lighting and the rest, is that it's calm. It's a nice, it's a good place for self-reflection as well.
Yeah, like you were saying earlier, like site specificity is so important to understanding Jeff's work too. So to take it outside of like this context that you know you may typically see it in is something that's really like it changes it and it brings this awareness. Like a lot of people had seen Jeff's work over at his site, but then when they saw it in the gallery, it really kind of like it did something different for them. It like had a different way for them reading the work. So that was really cool for me at our reception.
So listening to you two, I'm getting a mental image of something that is a common theme, perhaps a defiant efflorescence of creativity in the face of oppression, in the
yes.
case of Jeffrey, oppression just from the economic and social circumstances of being outdoors, living outdoors, and Ariella, the oppression of you know, having to confront whiteness as a black person.
Yeah, that was, exactly. They're not exactly the same kind of stories, but yeah, like how we deal with like respectability in the face of oppression is like something I think they both deal with too, and they deal with it quite well, frankly, I don't, for lack of a better word.
But all that, the oppression on the side of the homeless could be dealt with more by more community support. I mean, people are facing these sweeps all the time, and it's not just a waste of my art when they do that. It's a waste of people's lives because it wastes people's time when these sweeps occur. If people have a problem with the way that the homeless present themselves, then they need to reflect about the way that the rest of this culture looks. It's creosote-soaked poles, it's tar roads, it's wires strung everywhere, it's buildings and it's cars. The homeless aren't a threat to public safety and health. The threats to our environment as a consequence of our consumption is a threat to our safety and health.
Well, that makes sense to me. Okay. What further do you have to say about the exposition?
Just that I hope that people will come down and see it, or even from what you've heard so far, people like to go to the rivers or the ocean and collect driftwood, but it ends up those pieces get set someplace and then they just get cobwebs. I'd like to see people begin to interact more with their environment and see what they see and what they can make out of simple materials, an interactive way of becoming more involved in the spirited world.
Is it difficult to hook up all of the monitors and I presume computers to make the Ariella's display work?
We had a little bit of a wrestle with it. Ariella brought in a lot of the equipment and they already knew a lot about how it worked, so that was really good. But then when it came to like integrating with our technology, we had to fiddle with it. But that's okay. You know, we're a student-run gallery. We're one of the only ones in America that are run that way, where we're not showing student art, but rather contemporary artists who are in the midst of their career or are like getting to this new point in their career. I really love using art in my curatorial practice as a way of engaging the world around us and getting people to see things differently and perspectives that are often kind of marginalized or pushed to the side, or underserved is a word that I saw lately, and I really, that resonates with me, is like curating art is a service to the artist and to the public who engages it. And Littman and White Galleries have been doing that together for over 50 years now at Portland State. So just to have been part of that when I was in college was a really, I don't know, I really took it seriously when I was in school. So I hope people will always support that while they're here in Portland.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to describe this. Radio is theater of the mind, and so
right. It's
I've enjoyed trying to form some idea of what the exhibit would look like in my mind, and
well,
I'm sure
you.
It'd be a pleasant surprise to go and see what it really looks like.
Hopefully you'll get to, you know, get out of the heat, get out of the smog, you know, just go to PSU. It's free to the public. Not just BSU students. So.
And what hours again?
They are open from 12 to 5, Monday through Wednesday, and Thursday, Friday, it's from 12 to 6 at Portland State.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you two very much for coming in. And
thank you.
And again, that was KBOO's Teresa Mitchell speaking with artist Jeff Litticoat and the curator of the Littman Gallery, Ariella.
As reported by Street Root News, Northwest Natural has been buying up water utilities in Oregon since last December. They also report that privately held water companies often charge more. than those that are public. In the state of Pennsylvania, there is a stark difference. Privately held companies often charge around 64% more than their public counterparts. They also provide less transparency. As stated by the organization Food and Water Watch, privatization limits public accountability. Multinational water corporations are primarily accountable to their stockholders, not to the people they serve. Although Northwest Natural has not discussed their plans for the newly acquired water utilities, they did state that it was the first step in a broader strategy. The Oregon Citizens Utility Board says that they're not worried yet because the company is buying public utilities, adding that a lot of gas companies are looking to diversify as much as possible in order to move away from gas.
Work on the Salmonberry Trail has started in Tillamook. In April, the Salmonberry Trail Intergovernmental Agency voted unanimously to sign a lease with the Port of Tillamook Bay to convert the old rail corridor into a multi-use trail. A storm heavily damaged the original railroad line back in 2007, making it unusable. The project will take a strip of land and repurpose it into an 84-mile trail that will connect 8 coastal cities and 2 counties from Banks to Tillamook. Project leaders say the path will be a recreational attraction to bring in tourists that will boost local economies. They say the path will enhance safe outdoor activities for visitors and local residents while maintaining and improving the surrounding environments through river, forest, and coastal cleanups. The massive undertaking is projected to take several decades to complete. The first mile of the Salmonberry Trail connects the Tillamook Cheese Factory to downtown Tillamook. That part's expected to be complete by late fall. Coordinators hope to develop the trails from Banks to Tillamook at about the same time, with the projects eventually connecting in the middle.
New York University has announced it will now make medical students' college path tuition-free. This decision applies to all medical students at NYU, regardless of need or merit. The university's decision is an attempt to bring more medical students to important jobs such as medical research. The economic boon would reduce the situation in which students only take high-paying jobs in order to alleviate the burden of six-figure debts in student loans. This was made possible by several donors. Two in particular are Kenneth and Elaine Langone, the owners of the Home Depot empire, who have given the school $100 million for the program. This move is part of a growing trend across the nation, with schools such as UCLA funding up to 20% of tuition for medical students and the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine following suit.
Earlier today, President Trump threatened to sue drug makers that manufacture opioids. During a cabinet meeting, the president asked Attorney General Jeff Sessions to bring a lawsuit against companies marketing opioids and also asked him to look into drug trafficking from China and Mexico. Sessions said he would follow the president's request. Trump also accused China and Mexico of, quote, sending their garbage and killing our people. The federal government has joined several lawsuits filed by state governments. More than 25 states, as well as various municipalities and Native American tribes, have filed more than 1,000 lawsuits against drug makers. The suits argue that aggressive marketing of prescription painkillers have contributed to the addiction epidemic. Earlier this week, the state of New York announced it's suing Purdue Pharma, the manufacturer of OxyContin. The state alleges that the company downplayed the risk of addiction in its marketing of the drug. Trump added in the cabinet meeting, quote, it's almost a form of warfare. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that 72,000 Americans died of a drug overdose in 2017 alone. That number represents a 10% increase from the previous year.
The Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, passed away earlier today at her home in Detroit, Michigan. She was 76 years old. According to her publicist, Gwendolyn Quinn, Franklin died of advanced pancreatic cancer. During her lengthy and legendary career, Franklin released more than 100 singles on the Billboard charts, including 17 top 10 singles and 20 number one R&B hits. In 1987, she became the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She received 18 Grammy Awards, along with a Lifetime Achievement Award given to her in 1994. Rolling Stone magazine listed her as one of the best, ranking her number one out of 100 greatest singers of all time. Even though she had been ill since 2010, she continued singing and thrilling her fans. Her last performance at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City during the 25th anniversary gala for the Elton John AIDS Foundation in November of last year.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned at the end of this newscast for a live, in-depth interview with Miles Strong on the Black Male Achievements program. It's called Black on Black. Then at 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Queen Talk. Tonight's weather will get down to 56 degrees in Portland with partly cloudy skies. Areas of smoke and haze may reduce visibility. Tomorrow, there will be a high of 81 degrees with a few afternoon clouds. Today in history, in 1977, Elvis Presley was found unconscious in his Graceland mansion. He was rushed to a hospital where he was pronounced dead at the age of 42. And our quote of the day has to be from Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, who passed away earlier today. She said, quote, "We all require and want respect, man or woman, black or white. It's our basic human right. We are going to miss her. God bless."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada's west coast city of Victoria, British Columbia, the statue of the country's first prime minister has been removed. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the city calls the removal a gesture of reconciliation toward Indigenous groups.
He may have been Canada's first prime minister, but he was also one of the architects of the country's residential school system. And for the past year, a small but vocal group has been calling for his bronze statue to be removed from in front of Victoria's City Hall. In a recent move, the city council voted 7-1 in favor of doing just that, and within a couple of days, in the pre-dawn hours, it was taken down and put into storage. MacDonald served as prime minister for nearly 20 years. He has long been celebrated as the main force behind Confederation, but others say he was partly responsible for the misery caused by the residential school system. This protester says the removal of the statue was needed.
John A. MacDonald was the architect of residential school, and because of that, 180,000 children were imprisoned in residential schools across all of so-called Canada.
Others, however, say the city is guilty of historic vandalism and is erasing history. And at least one city councillor says he doesn't believe taking down the statue will advance reconciliation. That statue will now go into storage until a decision is made about its future. In a sidebar, the newly elected government of Ontario says it will take the statue. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Two Native women running for Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota may differ when it comes to policies, but they acknowledge history in the making, being chosen with their running mates after this week's primary. They join a group of Native women candidates claiming victory in races across the United States. Donna Bergstrom, a member of the Red Lake Nation, is on the Republican ticket for Lieutenant Governor. She says women have always been leaders in the community and culture keepers.
So I think this is an extension of our willingness to step up and serve. And what I think is that, this is our home. America is our home. This is where we're, from. And I don't think we're afraid to step up and say we want to serve and help. And I think people are more comfortable now being able to step into this realm. I think it's just terrific.
Democratic candidate Peggy Flanagan is a citizen of the White Earth Nation. She says it's great to be part of the sisterhood of Native women running for political office.
One of the reasons that I decided to step up and do this is that so often Native women are invisible or disposable. And it is really important to me as the mom of a 5-year-old little Anishinaabe girl that she see herself reflected in the leadership in the state, and that she know that any pathway is open to her or other little girls of color or other Native girls.
One of them is expected to be the first Native American lieutenant governor of the state after November's general election. Both women say they look forward to working with the 11 tribes in the state and serve all people in Minnesota. U.S. Senator Tom Udall, vice chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, is requesting Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's record on Native American issues. In a letter sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Udall asks for information on Indian affairs and the nominee's time as staff secretary and White House counsel. Udall says decisions by the high court impact nearly all aspects of Native American life. Udall would like the records so his committee can consider Kavanaugh's view of Indian country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Israeli army has cleared itself of wrongdoing for an assault on August 1, 2014, in which 135 Palestinians were killed in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. The attack, which is referred to as Black Friday, was part of a seven-week assault on Gaza. The Israeli army said it would not prosecute commanders who were involved, arguing that the investigation found no reason to suspect criminal misconduct. However, Hamas spokesperson Hazem Qassim said the investigation has no legal or political basis. He added, quote, "How can the offender be the judge of the very assault they committed? This was an attack that the whole world witnessed, and this is an attempt by the Israeli army to escape legal punishment." Some international rights groups, including Amnesty International, has said the Israeli army indiscriminately and deliberately targeted civilians during the Black Friday assault. The Amnesty International report on the incident stated, quote, "There is overwhelming evidence that Israeli forces committed disproportionate or otherwise indiscriminate attacks, which killed scores of civilians in their homes, on the streets, and in the vehicles, and injured many more. This includes repeatedly firing artillery and other imprecise explosive weapons in densely populated civilian areas. In some cases, there are indications that they directly fired at and killed civilians."
Two mosques in the United Kingdom were attacked using a catapult last night during evening prayers. The Masjid Kamalul Islam Mosque nearby Al-Hijra Mosque in Birmingham were hit with ball bearings fired from a heavy-duty catapult. The projectiles smashed several windows, however, no one was injured in the attacks. Law enforcement said they have opened an investigation into the incident, which is being treated as a hate crime. They also announced that extra officers would be deployed in the area as a precaution. Hate crime monitor group Tell Mama UK said that there appears to be a pattern of an increase in Islamophobic incidents following attacks in Britain. On Tuesday of this week, a 29-year-old man from Birmingham was arrested on suspicion of terrorism after crashing his car into security barriers. The group added that there was a 700% rise in anti-Muslim incidents following the attack at the Manchester Arena in May 2017, when 22 people died and hundreds were injured during a performance by singer Ariana Grande.
Flooding caused by heavy monsoon rains in the southern Indian state of Kerala has killed at least 73 people and displaced more than 85,000 residents. According to state officials, many of those killed were crushed under debris from landslides. Rescue operations are underway. The federal government has sent further aid to assist local efforts. Additionally, one of India's busiest airports has been closed due to a flooded runway. Chief Minister Pinarayi Vijayan told reporters, "We are witnessing something that has never happened before in the history of Kerala. Almost all dams are now open. Most of our water treatment plants are submerged. Motors are damaged." Kerala has 41 rivers that flow into the Arabian Sea. Schools in all 14 districts within the state are closed, and some districts have restricted tourism due to safety concerns. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi tweeted that he asked Defense Ministry to further step up the rescue and relief operations across the state, praying for the safety and well-being for the people of Kerala. A local resident, Krishni Jayan, said she was at home sleeping when friends woke her up. She added, quote, "I opened the door and water gushed in. When we stepped into the street, we were neck deep in water." She also said that locals tied ropes along the street to help people wade through all of that deep water.
The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that aims to keep the news honest. Here's today's roundup.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, August 16, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Trump responds to a critic by revoking the security clearance of a former CIA director Also on the Thursday rundown, farm groups urge speedy passage of the farm bill, and newspapers nationwide published editorials denouncing anti-press rhetoric. First, our top story, President Donald Trump abruptly revoked the security clearance of ex-CIA Director John Brennan Wednesday. Yahoo News calls it an unprecedented act of retribution against a vocally critical former top U.S. official. Yahoo adds that Trump also threatened to yank the clearances of a handful of individuals. All are critics of the president or are people whom Trump appears to believe are against him. Meantime, from USA Today, the jury in the financial fraud trial of former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort expected to begin their deliberations today. Politico reports that final arguments to the jury, prosecutors cast the former Trump campaign chairman as a serial liar in a years-long scheme to hide millions of dollars in 31 foreign bank accounts and to obtain millions more in a series of fraudulent bank loans. There are stark differences between the House and Senate farm bills. Tremell Gomes tells us faced with the lowest farm income in 12 years, the country's two largest farmers' advocacy groups are calling on congressional negotiators to find a quick compromise.
The farm bill provides support to farmers, ranchers, and rural communities, and also funds the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. House Republicans and President Donald Trump are pushing for stricter work requirements for SNAP that opponents say would make things harder for those in need. And Dale Moore with the American Farm Bureau says tariffs, trade disruptions, and lower commodity prices are taking their toll on the farm economy.
Our job as farmers and ranchers is to feed the world. So, you know, again, we're looking for programs that work, programs that make sense, just as, that same kind of approach is applied to a number of the other provisions in the farm bill.
There is no work requirement for SNAP recipients in the Senate version. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he wants a final bill ready for votes in the House and Senate shortly after Labor Day.
From California, Suzanne Potter reports backers of commercial property tax reform have submitted 860,000 signatures to county registrars for an initiative on the November 2020 ballot.
The Schools and Communities First ballot measure would require commercial property owners who benefited from Prop 13's property tax freeze in 1978 to start paying taxes based on the property's current fair market value instead of on what it was worth 40 years ago. Joshua Peschtolt, who heads the California Federation of Teachers, says it would raise another $11 billion a year, a good chunk of which could be used to improve schools.
California is the fifth largest economy in the world, and yet we're ranked something like 45th in terms of per pupil spending and class size average. And our kids deserve to be treated better than that.
A coalition of almost 300 community groups supports the proposal, which would not affect Prop 13 protections for homeowners, renters, small businesses, or agriculture. Anti-tax groups say it would make California significantly less business friendly and cause job losses.
Corporations that have owned large tracts of land since the 70s, like Chevron, Bank of America, Disneyland, and Universal Studios, would be the most affected by the change. An outside-the-box approach to criminal justice in Nebraska, helping to decrease the chance of formerly incarcerated people returning to prison. Eric Galatis reports it's also saving taxpayer dollars.
The Community Justice Center's restorative justice classes help offenders break down and identify the emotional, physical, and financial harm experienced by their victims. The program also gives people skills they'll need when they rejoin communities. Rick Carter with the center refers to the practice as creating better emotional hygiene.
Things are broken way before they've ever been caught for a specific crime. How do you go back and address the way you dealt with your own issues and deal with them differently as you move forward? How do you make better choices next time?
According to a recent study, probationers who completed the center's restorative justice program were half as likely to re-enter the system.
And finally, newspapers in Oregon and across the nation are publishing editorials promoting freedom of the press today in response to President Trump's persistent attacks on the media.
The Boston Globe coordinated this effort and has been joined by big newspapers such as the New York Times, the Denver Post, and the Chicago Sun-Times, as well as regional papers. Fred Obey is head of the Washington Newspaper Publishers Association, which represents about 80 small daily and weekly papers across the state. He says many of the papers in his network will be publishing editorials because the president's rhetoric about the press has affected them.
It was filtering down to all kinds of local journalism to the point where we're seeing people in our states working for small newspapers getting the same kind of treatment from public officials and other people who are running for election, and we just felt like things had gone too far.
Trump frequently has called the press the enemy of the people and fake news. About 350 newspapers had joined this effort as of Wednesday. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Radio Television Digital News Association also has joined with newspapers encouraging TV and radio stations to release editorials denouncing attacks on the media. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. So call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Corbin-Dogblue, Annette Newell, Teresa Mitchell, and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Grace Ann Smith, and our engineer is Mike Fataklu. The interim KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Directors are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Philomath on translator K2A2BH at 104.3 FM, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani takes your calls. At 9, Veterans Voice Radio deals with the health issues of vets and the after effects of war. At 10, Valley Views talks to the director of the STEM Academy at Oregon State University about efforts to provide access to science and technology to underrepresented groups. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, From the Vault celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Pacifica Radio Archives recordings from 1968 with Martin Luther King Jr., Joan Baez, Muhammad Ali, Allen Ginsberg, and more. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
And today, as part of KBOO's in-depth interviews, Teresa Mitchell is talking to Miles Strong of Black Male Achievement in Portland about their Black-on-Black mentoring effort. Teresa?
Welcome to KBOO In-Depth. Well, indeed, we are talking about Black Male Achievement Portland. This is a Portland program, and according to what they print out, Black Male Achievement is designed to assist city leaders in their efforts to improve the life outcomes of black men and boys. And BMA will help improve the life outcomes of black men and boys in four key areas: education, employment, family stability, and criminal justice. And so I'm lucky to have here in the studio live right now, Miles Strong.
Hello.
Hello. I'm so glad that you could come in. And I'd like to ask you, what brought you to this sort of activity?
Well, what brought me to BMA, one of my buddies actually, they texted me, and the person who I'd say is running BMA, he just sent me his number, and he said, hey, his name's Walter. He said, hey, Walter said, hit him up. So I texted Walter, and that's how I got into the program.
So friend of a friend?
Friend of a friend,
you,
yeah,
you
yeah.
Wanted to draw you in, wanted to get this sort of mentoring thing going on, and what I see that... Black Male Achievement has been pretty busy this summer, but what sort of activities have you been able to participate in so far?
Yeah, so basically we have been moving from place to place. We meet each Friday, so once a week on Friday, and we move from place to place. We've met at Wieden and Kennedy, Nike, Intel, WeWork, multiple different corporate settings, and we've just been moving place to place, and we've been planning the event, which is on the 18th of Saturday. And so, so we've just been moving around, getting exposure to these work sites and these people, and it's been a great experience. And
That sounds pretty fascinating to me. Did you get to go inside that great big Nike compound?
Yeah, we went to the Nike headquarters, and they had amazing buildings, it was just amazing. A bunch of different things to see at Nike. So
and Intel's a big campus too.
Yes, Intel is very big. We actually
they're pretty security conscious.
Yeah,
I think.
So basically, we didn't get to see all of Intel since, as you know, it's so big. We saw one section, which was actually the small section, but it was still fun and it was still a good experience.
What was it like at Wieden and Kennedy? Is that downtown?
Yeah, Wieden Kennedy downtown. That was great. Wieden Kennedy, it's an amazing building. Lots of natural light coming in, and they really have a creative culture, I'd say.
That's what I was going to guess. It's like, I bet it's a bunch of really sparky types, because that is the high-powered ad agency.
Yep, exactly.
They come up with all those ideas that, you know, pretty much flip those upside down when they feel like it.
Right, right, right.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To go in there. So that was pretty cool. And how many people were with you when you were?
So there's, I'd say, about 20 of youth in this program. And the people, I'd say the staff, there's about, I'd say five staff, if not more. But so it's, I mean, not too big of a number. But you know, we're still growing and working it out. So
yeah, I see a note here that said that y'all went to Elemental Tech as well.
Yes,
I don't even know what that is, but sounds technical.
Yeah.
So is that that's probably just part of the mentoring program?
Yeah. So what their goal is to put us and expose us to people, because the group is of black males, and so their goal is to expose us to black people in you know, the corporate industry, and just to show us that, you know, people have made it there, and also get us connected as well. So if we could reach out, so they set it up to where we could reach out to those people, and you know, get help, whatever help they need, because they're willing to help us. So it's a two-way thing, and you know, they're really all about us. They're all about the participants of the BMA group, and so
it's got this motto: education, employment, family, stability, criminal justice. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So well, by having us there, we build a relationship with each other, and I guess that would be the family part. You know, we're just coming together as a group of guys and just building that brotherhood, and it's really something special. And as well as,
are you getting to know people in the group pretty well?
Yeah, we're getting to know very well. With this event that we're throwing, we have to talk to each other a good amount, you know, whether we like it or not. But I mean, it's good because it just gets us closer, you know. So I mean, yeah, I've been gaining a lot of new friends from this, and a lot of brothers through this program. So,
and that implies stability.
Yeah.
Where's the criminal justice come in?
The criminal justice, well, it keeps us away, gives us something to do, because you know, a lot of times when you don't have something to do, that's how you slip into, you know, mischievous activities. So by giving us something to do and giving us something to come out to, and also inspire us with these meetups, you know, we meet up and we see these people and we get inspired by it. So it just gives us something to look forward to, as well as inspire us, and as well as keep us out of trouble by giving us something to do. So
this is a 501c3 educational foundation, the KBOO. Mm-hmm. And so I'm guessing that education in this case is your experience in these workplaces, or is there more to it than that?
There's more to it than that. I mean, we have a panel with these with the people who work there. They come and they speak to us about a certain set of questions, and they just answer our questions as well. And so whatever we have questions on, we learn about it, and they're helpful.
Did you feel about those workplaces, did they feel somewhat less alien after you'd been in there and met with people?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it just shows you that, you know, there's people out there of colored skin that are in the workforce and that are working, and that it's really inspiring because it makes me feel like I can do it as well, and I'm sure for the other guys it does that as well.
Is there any direct path to employment from this process?
I wouldn't say, I guess so. I mean, by getting connected, you know, you kind of have to work the employment part out, you know, by emailing and following up with these people. But there's opportunity if we take it. It's up to us, I'd say.
It seems like a very positive thing.
And, yes.
You seem to be pretty up on it. Can you tell me about this new program then, Black on Black?
Oh yeah, Black on Black, that is the name of our event. Basically, it's a community event, and we're having all people come out, and there'll be vendors, food, there's going to be a panel about business, and also games and fun, and it's just going to be a great time, just a time to, you know, have fun and enjoy on your Saturday.
When and where is that happening then?
That is at King Elementary School. Starts at 11 to 1:30. I believe the address for King is 4906 Northeast 6th Avenue. That is 4906 Northeast 6th Avenue.
All right. And so King Elementary, 4906 Northeast 6th Avenue this Saturday, I think I heard you say.
Yes.
From 11 to 1:30. And that is for Black males.
Yes. Everybody can come out. We were just saying we wanted to create what we call a space, a Black space where people of color can come together and just enjoy each other and just see each other. You know, in Portland, it's predominantly a white area. You know, so it's always nice to be able to come together with the community and see people. Just like you, but as well, it's not excluding any other race. You know, it's inclusive, so anybody can come out. But
how do you? What sort of funding is available for this program? Is this principally coming through the City of Portland?
City of Portland, and I believe I know we've got funding from City of Portland. There's one other place I'm not exactly sure on. But City of Portland, yeah, they've helped fund us.
Of the trips that you've been on, are there any that particularly appeal to you? Is there something that you saw and said, yeah, maybe I want to do that?
Yeah, for me, I'm really interested into, you know, shoes and clothing. So the Nike was really cool for me to see because, you know, you see the people and you hear about what they do. And it definitely sparked interest in me and something that I could, you know, work on.
Do you think you'd be more into the design of the shoes?
Yeah, I think so. I like
materials
creating.
Design.
Yeah,
or
more like I'd say, yeah, the design part, like sketching and, you know, creating a shoe design. I feel like that would be a cool thing to do. Like,
there's a lot goes into those things. I remember when I was young enough to run around in Nikes, I was really impressed that they could make them so bouncy that I could tell the difference. I thought it was just. I've got a note saying, is there a similar program for Black girls?
From my understanding, I do not think so, but I'm sure that will come, you know. We don't want to exclude anybody. So I guess that should be something, that should be their next move, you know, including, you know, all genders.
Well, it's pretty exciting to hear about this. It certainly does sound like something that's moving forward and making things happen. Congratulate you for being a part of it. Did you want to say anything about, there is something I forgot to ask you about, come to think of it, the phrase, startups from the ground up. What's that
about?
Yeah,
so startups from the ground up. So as I said earlier, we'd have a panel on business. So startups from the ground up is basically referring to that. So with a business, you know, sometimes you have to start from the ground and go up from there. So that's where that saying came from. And so at the event, we'll be having a panel about business. So if you want to start up, that's a perfect time to get some knowledge and some tips about starting a business.
Yeah. Well, Miles Strong, it's been good to see you, and I thank you very much for coming in to KBOO today.
All right, thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Black on Black Startups from the Ground Up on Saturday, August 18th at King Elementary School in Portland. Black on Black Startups from the Ground Up is focused on Black businesses and Black spaces and is hosted by the 2018 Black Male Achievement Summer Youth Experience Cohort.
Again, that's Black on Black Startups from the Ground Up on Saturday, August 18th at King Elementary School, 4906 Northeast 6 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage underneath Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted.
This is Cat Meow.
And this is Becky.
And we want to hang out with you.
The Development Committee will meet the third Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m.
We're traffic informed and
food motivated.
And we're seeking like-minded individuals who want to use their rad fundraising skills and talents to
support the station. Join us.
Join us.
Tune in on Thursday, August 30th at 8 p.m. to celebrate the Native programmers and the Native community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Jack Malmstrom of Rose City Native Radio will host this special on-air program. You can join us at the Native Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 30th. More information about the Native Community Open House and the anniversary programming can be found at kboo.fm.
The time is 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Rose City Native Radio is coming up next. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Dispatch with Naco and Medicine for the People and Scatter Their Own, Friday, August 24th at the Oregon Zoo Amphitheater. Starting at 7 p.m., doors open at 5 p.m. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information online at zooconcerts.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the August OMSI After Dark, featuring Insexuality, Ultrasonic Love Songs, and Death Dances from the Panamanian Rainforest on Wednesday, August 29th at 7:30 p.m. at OMSI in Portland. What does the world sound like to an insect or a bat? You can find out by exploring the insect music you've never heard before in surround sound under the Panamanian